So just, it would be nice to sit for a few minutes more just to feel the pleasantness of the breeze and the pleasantness of being in the sounds of nature as well. There's something very helpful about being in nature, even though technically we're only a few meters inside, but we're somewhat removed from something that feels very pleasant. I think it's not just the coolness of the breeze, the gentle breeze after a hot day, but you can almost feel the nature calming down. I guess it's also felt as the temperature comes down a little. But nature, the creatures are getting ready to settle for the night. And obviously there's no wind, there's no storm, it's a clear sky. Everything begins to feel a bit still and quite pleasant. So this kind of thing in the external world around us is actually very helpful for meditative practice. You know, it's no wonder the Buddha encouraged his disciples to meditate in the forest. There is an element of intentionally moving away from the hustle and bustle of a town, moving away from the otherwise commitments we might have in the town, either with family or work, as lay people at least, but even as monastics, you know, the closer we live to busyness, as we can experience in the early part of the day when we pick up our work duties, and sometimes we have lots of people coming in the early part of the day. You can see how the mind quickly gets drawn into activity. Not that activity in itself is a problem, but we can see how it stirs up the mind, and mind connected so intimately connected with body, how it can also affect the body in different ways. These different modes of our being in the monastery is good for learning, good for reflecting on how we are in different modes of different periods of the day, different modes of activity. But yet the Buddha really encouraged people to actually seek solitude, at least those who are on the meditative path, the monastic path, to seek solitude, to seek seclusion, to seek a natural setting. In the Chula Sunyata Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, he actually talks about, sunyata means emptiness, and he actually talks about the perception of emptiness and the descent into emptiness by starting with moving away from a town to a quiet area, and noticing that this area away from the town, let's say in a forest, is empty of people, is empty of the noise of town, the activity of town. Just to notice that. It's empty of what is not there. And that this is as obvious as it sounds, by noticing that, the mind, one's attention, one's awareness, is almost mingling with that. By bringing your attention to that, you're noticing the emptiness of something, or the absence of something. And he continued in that vein, you know, going into a private place, maybe an empty hut. You know, it's empty of what is not there. And yet there is still something there, maybe just the wooden floor, the windows, and starting to notice what is not here and what is here. But now there's more space in the mind, more quietude to see more clearly. And then it goes more inwardly in developing the meditation, all the way up to the, you know, the high jhanas, that there's always, as more and more refined states of mind, he's instructing his disciples to notice that it's empty of the grosser level of things. Empty, you know, once the mind goes beyond certain perceptions of body, or even beyond the hindrances, it's the job of wisdom, of the wisdom mind, of the knowing mind, to understand that the mind may be empty of hindrances, but what is present is this. And typically when the mind is empty of the five nivarana, the hindrances, what is present would be a sense of piti or sukha and one-pointedness of mind. And these are the jhana, some of the jhana factors. As the higher jhanas, as the meditation develops into higher jhanas, even the piti and the sukha disappears because they're at a more gross level by comparison. But in this sutta, the Buddha's always instructing in terms of understanding emptiness. You understand what's not here, what's now absent, what was here previously is no longer here, but then you notice what is here. So it's interesting when he gets, I mean, I haven't reviewed this sutta for a long time, I guess it just came to mind because of sitting in the coolness of the evening and things feeling like they're emptying out internally and externally. So I haven't reviewed this sutta recently, but from my memory, towards the end of the sutta where the disciple is actually gone through all the jhanas and has actually fully awakened, is now fully enlightened, and the Buddha instructs to still notice that the mind may be now empty of greed, hatred and delusion, which was previously there, is now empty of greed, hatred and delusion. And yet what is here, there is still, I'm trying to get the right wording, there is still whatever disturbance there is connected with the six senses, dependent on this body and conditioned by life. So this is a really interesting teaching, because even for one who's just fully realized, fully awakened, there's no more greed, hatred and delusion in the mind. It's empty of these powerful forces, and yet the Buddha says, and recognize there is this. There is that amount of disturbance that is still dependent, that is related to the six senses, dependent on this body conditioned by life. So there is still the activity of the six senses, but no longer stirring up greed, hatred and delusion. Nevertheless, it is there, dependent on this body, which is old karma, having been born and having even gone beyond the effects of greed, hatred and delusion in the mind, which is very hard for any of us to imagine if we're not fully awakened. It's very hard to imagine what that would be like, to be completely without ignorance, without greed, without hatred, without delusion, influencing the mind, distorting the mind's perception of things. And yet there is still the karma of this body, the karma of the senses, the sensitivity of this body and the mind that perceives the senses. So this is a really good reality check, because many of us can somehow conceive of full enlightenment as getting away from the dukkha of the body or the dukkha of the senses. But the Buddha is clearly saying, you know, that is still present. If one is skilled, one can escape temporarily those perceptual, those fields of perception by going into deep states of jhana or by concentrating on the deathless element itself. But the Buddha said even these states are temporary. So as long as this body is alive, there is this sense activity. So the reality check is just recognizing we're not trying to get away from anything here. In fact, full awakening, as the Buddha's described, is only possible in this body, in this mind. Awakening is here and now. In this fathom-long body, together with mind and perception, is dukkha. The arising of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the path leading to cessation of dukkha. The deathless reality, the goal of this whole path, to realize the deathless, to realize the truth of the unconditioned reality. The Buddha's pointing that in fact it's already present, we just don't see it clearly, don't yet understand it, or understand the conditioned reality that occludes the vision of the deathless, the vision of the unconditioned, or the full comprehension of the deathless, the unconditioned reality. So there seems to be two possibilities in the path or the realization of this. Is that one recognizes the deathless element in and of itself from one's meditative steadiness. One recognizes that, and that in itself shatters delusion, shatters ignorance. Ignorance is undermined. When ignorance is undermined, greed completely, when it's undermined completely, greed, hatred and delusion is destroyed. The mind can no longer cling in the same way as it did. And the other, slightly different, seemingly slightly different approach is the coming into finer states of meditative experience whereby one increasingly let's go of the grosser forms of clinging quite naturally as one encounters these more refined states and inquires into what clinging still remains. And with the fading away of passion, or seeing that the activity of craving, the cause of suffering, and the activity of ignorance is in itself dukkha and the creator of dukkha, when the mind sees that clearly, it no longer clings or it lets go of, in fact it becomes dispassionate or becomes nibbida, that word I talked about the other week we're here, which is translated in various ways. It can be as strong as repulsion or revulsion, or as kind of mundane as just getting tired of, losing interest in, pulling away from, becoming disenchanted with or disillusioned with the things that cause suffering, the things that create suffering when we see it for ourselves. And when the mind sees these things clearly, there's the natural arising of nibbida, which naturally leads to viraga, dispassion. And dispassion is described as the fading away of lust. Because one's seeing directly in one's own mind the first noble truth, this is dukkha, whatever one is facing or seeing or experiencing. When the mind sees that really clearly, when you see really clearly that one's clenching one's fingers and hands around a hot coal, the automatic response is to open your grasp and let it drop. And to me, this is kind of what this sequence conveys when one sees the dukkha of something clearly, without the distortion of the hindrances in the mind, this nibbida, losing interest in or becoming disenchanted with, disillusioned with, leads into dispassion, losing one's taste for something is part of nibbida. And dispassion is a consequent fading away of craving or clinging or lust. And then with that fading, the next part of that sequence is one comes to an experience of cessation or nirodha. Another interesting word that typically gets translated as cessation, but it's also talked about as the non-arising of suffering. Not just the cessation of suffering, but also that suffering no longer arises with nirodha. Because there's no longer clinging, there can be no suffering arising. When there's no longer ignorance and delusion about dukkha and the cause of dukkha, then no more suffering can arise. So this nirodha not just points to the cessation of suffering or the cessation of an experience that one has been clinging to or an object that one has been clinging to, but also means it no longer arises. And the consequent freedom of something no longer arising and entrapping one's consciousness in it. Because this experience of consciousness for those of us who are not yet fully awakened is an experience of entrapment in many different ways. When we're identified and clinging to certain things, our consciousness is actually bound up with that and suffers accordingly. Even if it has moments of pleasant experience, the existential experience is one of being bound to something, being delimited by something. And when that something, even if it's pleasant, when that something inevitably changes and ends, as is the truth of our nature with all conditioned things, then that consciousness experiences a kind of a death or a loss and the suffering that goes with that if we're identified either with that object or with the experience of that consciousness itself, that moment of sense consciousness. So cessation is talking about the experience of, after letting go, suffering ceases, the experience of that particular object or sense consciousness ceases, and one experiences freedom. Freedom from confinement, freedom from entrapment, nirodha. So nibbita, viraga, nirodha can often then lead, there's different sequences in the Buddha's teachings. I think nirodha, or after nibbita, viraga, we sometimes get the vimokkha or vimutti, the heart's liberation from the things it was trapped by. And this is similar to the non-confinement of nirodha. Also after nirodha we can get what's called vasaga or parinitsaga. Vasaga is the relinquishing, relinquishing of, after the experience of cessation, the freedom that heralds in, there can be this experience of completely relinquishing the basis of attachments. Because, not because of an intention, but because that the heart's been released and finds its freedom, much like a bird who is born, maybe who has been entrapped in a cage, is released and is able to soar. And that sense of, you know, relinquishing what it's leaving behind, it's as the heart is released and soars in its own true nature, it's leaving behind the confinement of attachments and clinging. And for me, personally speaking, coming back to how we opened this reflection, is when the day begins to come to an end, I personally experience a kind of a settling. Usually, if one's not too stirred up because of outer circumstances, but usually a settling after the day's activity, the heat of the sun, the glare of noon, in the dusk, in the twilight, as we move towards the darkness, towards the night, my own heart feels a kind of a relief, a settling. Somehow the daylight hours, kind of with, I guess it's the height of sense activity, isn't it? The senses can be so stimulated by everything that's going on. But as we move into the shroud of the night, the cloak of night, something settles. The sense activity can begin to settle. And one's just left with the mind. I was going to say pure and simple, but the mind is only pure and simple when we have very clear realization. Much of the time the mind is full of illusion and delusion. But something, nevertheless, in the letting go of the sense activity of the day, moving towards the restfulness of the night, feeling it in nature as well. Anyone can take advantage of this natural settling, this natural stilling, and just resting into the mind itself. So learning how to meditate, you know, is a long journey, I believe, because there are so many different teachings on meditation. Even within the Buddhist schools, there are so many different ways we can hear about in terms of cultivating meditation. But something that I can see in my own path more and more is how much intentional doing invades the mind in terms of trying to make the mind somehow other than the way it is, the way we're experiencing it. And there are certainly methods of practice that seem to highlight that we need to do something. Even the way we talk about the Eightfold Noble Path, one can talk about in a way that implies that there's quite a lot of doing. Let go of this and cultivate that. Put in effort here in different ways. But the more, in my own experience, the more I practice meditation, the more I see clearly that, well, not completely clearly, but more clearly, that this sense of doing, you know, it really has to come to a place of stillness. that this doer or the doing activity in the mind, even if it's, you know, turning your mind, turning your attention back to the breath, that is a skillful means. But I think we also need to inquire into this activity of doing, this intentional doing, this idea of trying to force the mind to be one way or another. I think can keep us involved in a certain activity that doesn't necessarily have to be there. Now, we might think, well, if I don't keep turning my mind back to the breath, you know, I just will never be present. That can be a fear that comes up in the mind, but actually it's worth exploring and experimenting. What is it just to be awake here and now? Just to be awake and aware of what's actually happening. I think this is what, if we're doing any cultivation, is just to keep waking up, to keep coming into full awareness. But that in itself doesn't actually require a lot of doing. It's more a kind of remembering. Because as soon as we remember to be awake, to be present, the other activity in the mind ceases for a moment. Or we can see more clearly what it is, that, this is a thought. In meditation tonight, I was noticing in one moment I can have a profound thought of how to point the mind towards a deathless element. And in the next moment, I was thinking about how to fix the ant problem in the kitchen. I saw, how can that be? I was right on the verge of entering the deathless, and then the ant problem, the next thought was how to fix the ant problem, and how absorbed my mind got into the ant problem. How to fix the ant problem. Why didn't it get absorbed into the deathless? Instead, this was just some reflections. But noticing actually both of those were just two thought moments. They were both thoughts. Thought of turning the mind to the deathless element. And in the next moment or two, involved in new ideas of how to fix the ant problem. And then the next moment just reflecting, both of those are thoughts. Neither are the reality. They're just thoughts that arise and cease. So even our very highfalutin thoughts about the deathless is just another thought. It's not liberation. Or maybe, you know, a shocking thought or a terrible thought that runs through the mind. You know, we can get caught up in being repelled by that. But if we see it's just another thought that arises and ceases, it's just that much. But it's that in the mind which sees that and knows that, which is closer to the Buddha Dharma. Not the thoughts about the deathless or the thoughts about the Buddha Dharma, but that in the mind which knows and sees exactly what's happening and is not actually caught up in them. You know, if I persisted with my thinking about the deathless, I could easily perhaps believe that, it's within my, you know, I'm in this vicinity, you know, I may be a really good practitioner. But no. Or if I persist with the thoughts about the new solutions for the ant problem, I feel certain I can come up with some. But, you know, it's still more thinking. And maybe in meditation, maybe if one stays with one thought, being the thoughts about Dharma, they may have more possibility to keep the mind awake, potentially. but not necessarily. But that which knows thoughts as thought is actually already awake, is already free of entrapment in those thoughts. Whether it's a highfalutin thought, a refined thought, or a gross thought, a functional thought, a dysfunctional thought, a suffering thought, a pleasant thought, the mind which just knows it as an impermanent thought is already free of entrapment there. So this is the kind of waking up that's required in meditation. And in that kind of waking up, the mind quite naturally begins to find a sense of settling. Because if one takes refuge more in that which is awake, in that which knows, it is an empty place. That which knows, that which is awake, is not crowded out with thoughts, with activity, with doingness. It just is. And this is where we have to learn to, what we have to learn to trust and to take refuge in, to keep recognizing. It's a matter of remembering or recognizing or waking up. Waking up as opposed to remaining asleep or remaining in the rolling on of thought after thought, whether they're refined thoughts or gross thoughts. We need to wake up out of that movement of the mind and out of the illusion also that we have to do something to get somewhere else, which is our idea of awakening in the future. So this quality of wakefulness is already present, is already full. Is already empty, is already a refuge. Sometimes this quality of wakefulness can be referred to by the forest masters as the Buddha. The Buddha is that which is awake, that which knows within us. And even the Buddha said to one of his disciples, or in a teaching, he was saying, even if someone clings to me so closely, clings to my robe, if they don't see the Dharma, they don't see me. And he said, but someone far away who may have never met me, far away physically, if they see the Dharma, they see me. So the Dharma is, in this sense, is pointing, I believe, to the deathless reality, the ultimate reality, the unconditioned, the Buddha who is awake to that truth. But the Buddha is also awake to the conditioned reality, and that is actually what heralded in his awakenings, a full understanding of the conditioned world, the conditioned reality. Such a full understanding of that, to know that any clinging to that whatsoever, identification with that whatsoever, will keep one bound. But it's in the recognition, the understanding of the unconditioned, which is knowable within, which is present already within, that suffering can be completely abandoned, that the conditioned world is completely understood, not through getting rid of it, not through a disappearing act, not through a suppression of all the sense activity, but a full knowing of it, just as it is. So when he talks about the full knowing of it, all of that knowing, that understanding of the conditioned realm in terms of knowing it according to Dhamma, for the most part that is summed up in these three characteristics of existence. To see that the conditioned things that we experience and live with, they are changing, they are impermanent, they're unstable. To identify with them, to seek permanent happiness with them, to hold on to them will only produce dukkha. And to see that anything that is impermanent, changing, not productive of true happiness, to see that to cling to these things as a self is really not worth it. To call these things, or to find identity, essential identity in these things that are actually changing within our own direct understanding, within our own direct vision, we see the absurdity of that and the foolishness of that, really, which we haven't seen before. Because the habit of the mind for lifetime after lifetime, the habit of the world, the habit of our culture, is to seek identity in changing things. This is not in denial of these different bodies, these different personalities at all, but is to see that they are conditioned and that we won't find a permanent self within them. And actually, when we let go of the search of a permanent self within them, we find the stability of the Dhamma, the truth that is always here and now, to be seen individually, each wise person for themselves. To be known in this very body-mind. But to call that ultimate truth a self, the Buddha said, is absolutely not correct. It's not a self, it's quite an impersonal realization, and it's empty of the idea of self. The idea of self is only a thought grasping at a fleeting something. But the experience of the deathless, of the emptiness, the unconditioned reality, is a true experience, but nothing of which you can grasp at. And yet it is. So the Buddha is pointing to the way to freedom from suffering at all levels, that's realizable and verifiable for human beings in this very form. the end of suffering is the ending of greed, hatred and illusion, the undermining of ignorance. To talk about it in words can sound like a huge feat, and it certainly is a huge feat to be able to realize this, the fruit of this path to the full. But be careful to not let our ideas of what that is to lead us off the actual path. Because our path of practice is always about being here and now. Just seeing thoughts as thoughts, feelings as feelings, perceptions, memories, just as that in the moment. The body with all its aches and pains and carry on, just sensations, mostly out of our control, just the arising of karma, past karma. But as we experience it, as we we're willing to be with it without clinging, it keeps showing us how it keeps changing and how it's not really a permanent thing at all. It's a process. A biochemical process, really, a wonder in itself, but it's not worth clinging to as a me and a mine, as a what I am. Not worth being entrapped by, because it's only going one way. So we're here with these things, but we don't have to be trapped by them. As the Buddha was pointing to in that Chula Sunyata Sutta, to notice what this moment is empty of, to notice what's present and what it's empty of. And that this in itself can be a pathway to full realization and to coming to understand what it is, this experience of emptiness is not something just completely abstract but verifiable for oneself. And when the activity of the mind ceases for a while, we can notice the emptiness of that. And usually the Buddha talks about with the cessation of such activity there is peace. We notice the peace of the mind when things come to a natural stilling. And this non-agitation of the mind is also related to non-clinging, letting go of clinging, letting go of holding, letting go of craving. When the mind actually let's go, it comes into a place of peace, of stillness, of non-agitation. So I hope those few words will serve as some inspiration for us in our practice. I'll leave it there tonight.